Welcome to episode 2 of Neuro Women Matter.
Hi everyone, and thanks for joining us. God, I'm stuttering already. I'm only on the first sentence. Thank you for joining us for episode 2 of Neuro Women Matter with me, Charlie Hart, also known as Awesome Charlie with an AU for autistic, and Tony Horn. So, hi. I'll give you a quick audio description in case you're listening on the audio. So I am a 40 something woman with straight blonde shoulder length hair, and I have a countryside mural with a rainbow behind me. Tony, how about you?
Yeah, so I'm also a 40 something white woman with short bobbed hair with highlights, and I'm currently sitting in my office with a white background and my Think Differently logo.
So last month we talked about our childhood and particularly school, our school experiences. So we thought that it would be nice to continue that conversation. So I'm not going to give away every one of my secrets because I am writing a book about this particularly difficult period of my life, which is also quite racy and also has loads of humour. So, but we'll have a little bit of a chat about it and whet our appetites. And it's something I know virtually nothing about from Tony. So I'm really interested to find out more because, yeah, we're doing this podcast for you, but we're also getting to know each other better. Like we could be in the pub having a glass of wine and chewing the fat. And yes, so thank
you.
Yeah,
we did say when we get into the relationship one, though, Charlie, we do probably want to do this with a glass of wine in our hand.
Yeah. So I can't remember if you said you went to sixth form college or university or anything.
No,
can you jog my memory?
Of course I can. So
Yeah.
There was no way on earth was I going to stay at school and join another sixth form. So I went to drama school, college.
I'm
No
so
surprise,
jealous.
right?
Yeah. So I stayed at sixth form. Just because it was kind of expected. So I kind of tumbled along through my early adulthood. You know, I went to a school and I was in the habit of going there with my best friend. I continued to go and did A-levels there. Picked the subjects I found the easiest, didn't really know what I wanted to do. So just picked the ones that where I'd got A's at GCSE, but I'd got no kind of end in sight. And then very quickly, I got my first boyfriend and that was all I was interested in. So I had a job washing up in a pub kitchen, which I did quite often, like £2.50 an hour, all day Sunday, a couple of weekday evenings, Saturday evening. And I had a boyfriend who was a fair bit older than me, but not in a creepy way. So this is a bit weird because I was like 17 and he was 25, but also he was just as autistic as me, I think, looking back now. And he lived with his mum and he spent all of his time on his special, highly focused interests. So we were quite sweet together. But yeah, I lost interest academically. And I was expected to go to university because I was clever, but I really didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. So I picked French because it was one of the subjects that I found easier, and then got to university away from the boyfriend, away from my best friend, away from my family, completely fell off the rails. It was just like a drunken stoned haze and I was shagging around left, right and centre, showing up to lectures and remembering them, but not going to seminars because I felt awkward and didn't know who to sit with. Not doing my coursework because I didn't have a computer and I'd felt awkward about using the computer room because I'd missed the induction session. So I really had my head buried in the sand and got worse and worse and worse until I ended up doing glamour modelling and strippograms and flunking out of school. My parents actually drove up 150 miles to Lancaster to bring me this letter saying that I'd been excluded from university. And I opened the door to them and said, oh, that's thank you for that. And basically, but I'm going to a motorbike rally now. And so thank you, but I can't invite you in, and sent them away. So I was an absolute disaster. All that mattered to me was I'd find people I fancied and then pursue them relentlessly. Now, if it's a boy doing that, you would call it creepy and you would call it stalking.
Stalking.
Yeah, to me. I was infatuated with someone, so I was trying to be where they are and trying to give them a chance to see that I could be a good girlfriend to them. And it's really shitty behavior, and I'm really not proud of it at all now. But yeah, if I'd known about autism and highly focused interests and fixations, sibilance you call it when it's like a object of romantic interest or sexual interest, I've recently found that. So yeah, I'm kind of whipping through too much at once here, but yeah, I in my defense, I was left unsupervised and I had no idea how immature I was and how much support I actually needed, and how freaking disabled I was, how vulnerable as well. So how
The
about you?
vulnerability, yeah, the vulnerability I really connect with, really connect with. So,
Yeah.
do you know what? Whenever I speak to anyone about this, right, especially when you speak to somebody else who's neurodivergent, there is always a slight similar story.
Yeah.
Because I did performing arts and I absolutely loved it, and it was 3 years my course was, but I also had a college and I've been doing Latin American ballroom since I was about. Oh, must have been seven. Seven's probably when I started. And I really badly done my knee in. And it broke my heart because I couldn't dance anymore. I wanted to be a dance teacher and I wanted to do the Blackpool, and which carry on doing the Blackpool competitions and all this
Yeah.
stuff. And I just couldn't because of my knee. And it kind of sent me off the rails a little bit. And when you talk about that fixation, or how we do things completely out of spontaneity, I was always running away from. I think for myself. And when I look back from a very, very young age, I didn't want to be where I was. I always wanted to be somewhere else. So I went to Cyprus with a friend, and I met this young lad who was a soldier, and his name was Lee. And he completely ignored me. But I was instantly obsessed with him,
Yeah.
right? And I remember the guy that owned the one of the basically there was a guy that owned, I would say, the whole of Limassol in Cyprus, right? I think he owned about four different pubs. He basically him and his family probably owned like the whole street. And he offered me a job, and he said, "Do you want to become a dancer in my nightclub?" He said, "We have podium dancers that try to encourage girls and boys and that to kind of get up and dance." And I was like, "Oh my God, this is amazing." But I actually had a boyfriend back home. But this boyfriend I've been trying to split up with for about a year, right? And he was just as obsessive as I was. I used to work in a bar at the time. And this bar I'd worked in since I was eight. The minute I turned 18, I worked in this bar, in my local bar. And he used to come and sit at the end of the bar every time I was working, and I'd be like, "I
Yeah.
don't want to be with you anymore." And he was like, "No, I'm walking you home." I'm like, and in the end, I felt the need and I needed to escape. So I had this opportunity put in front of me. Now I'm 18, mind, right? To go and live in Cyprus, go and work for this guy, go work in his bar and work and dance, and also dance in his hotel. He had a hotel. And what he wanted me to do is because he wanted me to go and dance. They had a lot of older generation that went in there, and they had a big ballroom. And he spotted me going in one day, and there was this old guy that was sitting there on his own. And I went up to him and said, "Would you like to do the waltz?" And he was like, "Oh, I would absolutely love to." So I waltzed around the ballroom with this older gentleman, and he said, "Right, I want you to work in the ballroom every Sunday. I want you to work in the Irish bar 3 nights a week, and then dance in the nightclub on the Friday." So basically, work 6 nights a week.
Yeah.
And I remember coming home and saying to my mum and dad, "Can you drop me off at the airport next week? I'm going back to Cyprus to live." And they're like, "What? What do you mean?" And I'm like, "I'm quitting college. I didn't see the last year out of college. I quit college and went and moved to Cyprus because." One of the opportunity, two to escape, and three because of this guy that I've met. I mean, it's absolutely bonkers. When I look back at
Yeah.
it now and I think, what was I doing?
Oh no, I question pretty much every decision I made at that age. But, you know, I mentioned this really lovely boyfriend who I had who was a bit older when I was in sixth form, Andy. He really doted on me and he gave me an electric guitar. He taught me to play some songs got me really into his favorite bands, and he was just adorable. But as soon as I got to university, I wanted to play the field, not because I wanted to have a string of different boyfriends, but it was very much propping up my ego. And I wanted to have experiences with other women as well, because as you know, I'm bisexual. But I really callously dumped him just because I wanted to play the field. But the people that I went after, and I did go after them, like I made a play for them, pursued them relentlessly. I didn't really know them. It's just like I would see this person and get this idea that they tick all the boxes of what I'm looking for. So it could be charisma, it could be things like long hair and a motorbike and leather jacket, and they follow my favorite band. Things like
I
that,
would.
just pick somebody and go for them. So this is a really bad idea because they wouldn't be going for me. They'd just eventually relent. So there was always an
Just give up.
imbalance of power. Yeah. So and somebody wrote a book called "He's Just Not That Into You" many years later, and I thought, why did nobody give that to me when I was 18? Because it just made me into such a doormat, managing to worm my way into a relationship with someone that was just not that into me. And I
To
did it for.
me pursuing Lee in Cyprus, there's a story that goes alongside that, which coincides abuse, right? And I think when we do relationships, that to be fair, the majority of the conversation with me will be about that relationship, because it did turn into an abusive relationship, because I was so obsessed with being wanted by him that I become this complete submissive person that just wasn't me.
We're going to have to be in a really strong place for that because I've obviously got a similar situation. So I played the field all through university, but this one person who I particularly fancied, I ended up going out with for 4.5 years in a on-off, as in he'd keep losing interest and going off kind of relationship. But I always had him on a pedestal, no matter how shit he treated me. So he's the control freak arsehole that I sometimes refer to, because I don't believe in saying that someone's a narcissist unless they've got a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder. So, but he was, so I call it a control freak arsehole. But obviously, I
Turdos.
now think he probably had ADHD as well, but
That's no excuse.
it was a very destructive relationship. And when I met my first husband, although he wasn't exactly the love of my life, I could finally be myself and didn't feel like I was constantly being judged and negged. And so he was an important man in my life, my first husband. But yeah, I shouldn't have had to go through that period of all of that self-esteem destroying, constantly being told I'm not good enough, I speak too loud, I talk about things that people don't want to hear about, I lack grace, I've got to like tunnel vision about things that interest me, and I don't give a shit about politics and the World Cup and whatever else is going on. So yeah. Little taster, but
The
yeah.
other thing I reflect on as well is my relationship with alcohol when I was younger.
Yeah, me too.
Because I remember when I came back from Cyprus and then I moved to Blackpool, and that's a whole different conversation because that still relates to him, right? So if I take Cyprus and Blackpool out of the equation and I've come back, so I came back to Essex, I think, when I was just after my 21st, about 2 months after my 21st birthday. And I had lost contact with absolutely everybody, apart from my one best friend, who she will be my best friend forever. And, I've known her since I was 10 years old. And I just remember relentlessly feeling like huge amounts of anxiety of one, wanting to be out and be sociable, but two, not wanting to, and fighting with myself constantly. And I talked today, actually, on LinkedIn about high functioning anxiety. I've always had it, but never knew about it, never realized what it was. And I have these huge amounts of anxiety of, okay, well, I need to go out
Feeling
because I'm
of
really lonely, right? And I'm lonely at home, and I'm depressed because I'm at home and I'm on my own. So I need to get out. And alcohol was the only thing that I would fall back on to get me out of that. To get me out and socializing, because But then I would then have huge amounts of anxiety the next day of actually, well, I drank too much, then I become more of me, the real me.
I've
Everyone sees
still done
that.
that in more recent years, but
Yeah, I still do it now
yeah.
sometimes, Charlie. I really do. And on this, I was thinking, oh, they've seen me. Like, they're not going to like that version of me because they know the masked me. It's like a vicious cycle. And it's like I said, I still do it sometimes now, not as much. But it was a huge crutch when I
Yeah,
was
me
in my
too.
20s.
When I was at university, which was pretty brief, I was only there for like 8 or 9 months, but I used to smoke a lot of weed if I had problems that needed to be resolved. So I'd get high and then fall asleep early, thinking, well, I'll wake up at the crack of dawn and do that assignment. Had a door-to-door salesman, so he would come around and ask if I want an eighth, and I'd be like, yeah, I've only got a tenner though. He'd say, well, I'll come back in a few days and get the other fiver. But he would come back and I'd only have a tenner. So I constantly owed him a
You
fiver.
show him
So
fiver.
he looked like Jamiroquai from what I remember as well, like mad hats and dreadlocks. He was a white dude, but he had dreadlocks. And yeah, like a door-to-door cannabis salesman. But me and a lot of my friends took speed as well. Speed was the thing in the mid-90s in Lancaster where I lived. And I think it's that a lot of us had ADHD. So we were literally taking amphetamines to self-medicate ADHD. But
Yeah,
there's
I never really
so
got into
many.
weed because you should just send me asleep. And I was like, what's the point in this? I'd have a smoke and then I'd be asleep. And I was like, there's no point in me
That's
doing
it.
that
I had
whatsoever.
it since and it hasn't done that. But yeah, that's what I recall as well. He's smoking because my dad had smoked heavily all through my childhood and I hated it. So I was never going to smoke. But then when you get into smoking weed, you end up addicted to tobacco. But yeah, drink. So again, my dad was an alcoholic, so I never drank in sixth form when I was with Andy. He was always driving. He wouldn't drink, so I didn't drink. And I was quite anti-alcohol. I could have a good time without it because I was with Andy or with my best friend Karen, so I was comfortable. So I didn't need it. When I got to university, I was suddenly uncomfortable, out of my depth, struggling to find any particular group of people that I'd got anything in common with at all, and struggling with the sensory demands of going out clubbing and things like that. So, yeah, alcohol is the obvious thing. It's the obvious social lubricant, lowers your inhibitions, and it's the obvious thing to dull the senses as well, so that you can cope with the sensory environment of like dark clubs and pubs with disco lights and loud music and everyone talking at once. So I think it happens to a lot of us.
See, I do, and I think I used to use alcohol to dull that down because I used to absolutely love dancing. So when I went to a club, if you wanted to find me, I was on the dance floor, right? I was just constantly dancing. But the minute I came off the dance floor and I was surrounded by loads of people, I'd get so angsty and so like I remember just always feeling like I'm gonna explode. And I could never understand it. And I'd be like, just be normal. I remember Xanax to myself, just be normal, right? All your friends are here, just be like them, be normal.
They can have
Remember.
conversations as well, other people, like normies. They can have a conversation in a loud bar and they're not having to constantly say, what?
What?
What? Say that again.
How many times I got told to go and have my ears tested? I'm like, my hearing's fine, thanks. But there is so much more going on around me that I'd hear a conversation going on behind me. I'd be like, oh, that's interesting. And I've completely zone out.
I couldn't cut through all of the other noise to actually take in what the person was saying in my ear. I never have been able to, and I don't go to clubs now.
Oh
So I
no,
was
I'm
at
far
the
too old for that.
Professional Speaking Association Business Summit over the weekend, and I really wanted to talk to people all weekend, but it was very, very draining to me to try and like home in on what the person next to me was saying with all the other noise going on. Loop experience
Have you
helps a
tried them
bit.
in? Yeah, I was going to say, have you tried the loop ones? Because I've got a loop engage, and I find that they really help.
Yeah, they did help a bit, but it was back to
Young
early
adulthood.
adulthood. Yeah.
I
Yeah.
always remember Even with a large group of friends, some of them probably know this and a lot of them probably don't. There was a big group of us, and I used to always feel like the outsider. You know, I felt like I was the odd one out all the time. They'd have this conversation and they'll say something, and I just always remember getting a look. Like, what did you say that for? But like, have I said something that I shouldn't have said? And completely couldn't understand or gauge what it is that what I'd said that they'd all turned and looked at me at. I remember because I'm ridiculously early to absolutely everything, right? Even it's starting to get on my nerves now because I turn up early, I'm the first person there, but because I'm the first person there, I have to talk to people. Right, so I'm like, when am I going to learn to actually turn up late? Because, but I hate the feeling of letting people down or being late. I don't know what it is, but you know, sometimes like if there is something else there to excuse me to go to, and I'll give you an example, you know, when my friends have had children, this is before I had children, I would go and play with their kids rather than go and talk to the adults.
It's easier, isn't
It was just
it?
easier.
I will go and talk to people's cats at parties as well. That's even easier.
I don't like cats, Charlie.
Or dogs, but
Love a dog. So, what would you say, like, when was it a turning point for you? Because I don't think I've had that turning point. I think I've always tried to escape. If I can give you an example of where I've lived in my lifetime before I met my husband, I moved to Cyprus, I moved to Blackpool, I moved to Windsor. I'd moved to, I was at Liverpool for a bit, and then I came back to Essex. And even when I come back to Essex, I was here, there, and everywhere. And I felt like I was always trying to find something
I
or
think it's
escape
probably when I
something.
moved in here. So, Si and I have lived here for 7 years, I think it is. So, when we first got together, we lived in the house that he bought with his ex. So, I never really felt at home. But now we have a house that we bought together. And now I feel like I've arrived. So, not until my 40s. But I moved around a lot when I was younger. But it was always to do with romantic partners. No, it was never me going off to find my way in the world ever. And I never really had any time that I was single either. So it's just like I've been a serial monogamist all my life.
Yeah, to be fair, I'd had a couple of serious relationships before Dave, but nothing that I because but we're going back into that relationship bit, but I used to get the ick quite quick.
I've only had three serious relationships. So Gordon Graham, who probably wouldn't have described me as a serious relationship, to be fair. And then first and current husband. I'll say current, keep him on his toes, but
Bless him, poor Si.
I've seen what he's like to split up with. Like I was there when he split up from his ex, and I think it's probably way better to wait for him to die rather than ever split up with him.
Oh, poor
No,
Si.
we're very happy. So we have the
Good.
occasional blow up because
Who doesn't?
when you've both ADHD, it's so easy to say the wrong thing. We can be so oversensitive and yet so insensitive. So it's
Yeah.
great to have someone on the same wavelength, but it's not all a bed of roses. Well, there's a
No.
few pricks, but
Oh, I love it. I love it. It just it kind of like going back. I don't like, I always said, you know, before I would say probably good before I was 30, I just constantly felt lost. And I remember at one point, because I bought my first flat when I was 25. I was 25 years old and I bought a flat. And I was working in a, as you know, I used to work in a, quite a large banking firm. And I was quite successful, so I was working up in the city. I weren't earning a bad wage, and I thought that, and I'm one of these people. If I put my mind to something, that's it. That I'm like that. I'm getting it, and I won't stop until I get it. So my goal was to get this flat because I wanted to live on my own, and I didn't. As much as I love my mum, we're not good at living with each other. So I needed to get away from her again, because we are so much better off. We're the best people when we're not living with each other, right? But then I remember being so depressed, and I used to get so obsessed, like I'd make myself sick of, trying to do something to be, making sure that I liked the same music as they did, doing all the same things that they did. I'd download a whole entire new pod. I had one of my iPods, and my whole iPod would be like covered in the music that they liked, and I would do everything in my power. And I've always been a giver as well, so I would like go and buy people gifts, like spend my
Yeah, me
money on
too.
stuff.
Always been over generous and getting
Oh,
myself into debt. I did that a lot
ridiculous.
with the golden, after I'd left Lancaster, where I went to university and subsequently stayed. We split up. I moved back in with my mum, and he moved to Derby to do the Rolls-Royce graduate training program. And then we got back together. So I was going on my little 100cc motorbike up to Derby every weekend and literally buying groceries for him, who had a really well-paid job. And I was earning £100 a week in a insurance broker's. And then getting into debt on store cards because I wanted to look nice for him and buy clothes and shoes that were to his taste. And then getting cash back on store cards so that I could afford the petrol and the groceries to look after him. He did absolutely nothing for me. And I ended up 10 grand in debt. So.
I've always been such a people pleaser. Someone said to me, "Oh, we're going to go on holiday. Do you want to come?" Yeah, no worries. Not even thinking about the consequences of where we're going to find this money. And I worked for a bank, and I knew about debt, and I got myself in such bad debt. But then I also knew how to manage out of it as well, because I had that experience and that knowledge. But yeah, I just remember feeling lonely. Before I was 30, I would say one of the biggest things I remember is feeling lonely, even if I had people around me. I remember saying this in one of my keynote talks once, is actually I
The biggest time I feel lonely is actually when I'm in a room full of people that I know.
Do you mean? I said that's probably the biggest time I feel the most loneliest.
Because they don't really get it. And
No.
yeah, I
No.
felt like that too a lot. And even recently, but it's really changed though. Something has changed since I quit the stressful job and became self-employed. Because I'm finding it easier to connect with people. And I don't know if I've picked up skills or I'm just around people that are easier to connect with, or maybe they're all neurodivergent. I don't know. But suddenly, socially, my life has just become a lot easier.
Do you think it's because you're more in control of it though, Charlie? Because I think I've got so much more control over my life now that I run
Maybe.
my own business. That before I had no control. I was always at the beck and call of somebody else. I had to be at a place or in front of my computer by 8:45. I still had to be there by 5 o'clock. I don't have that demand on me anymore. And I think the flexibility has made it so much easier for me. And you hear it all the time, don't you? That a lot of neurodivergent people are going self-employed or building their own businesses because the corporate world is not built for them.
So I've got a strong urge to try and change the world a little baby step at a time in it's okay to be different and
Yeah.
please embrace all human diversity. Let us be our authentic selves. I don't want people to have to code switch. I don't want people to have to pretend there's something they're not. So stagecraft and things like that, great. Learning some skills, great. But let's not change the essence of who people are, because it just leaves them broken shells.
Yeah, it does. It does. And I've said to a lot of people, I will continue to mask. It's my coping mechanism. It's my defense mechanism. And I don't know how not to, but that's okay. That's mine, right? But I want my sons to be able to be who they want to be, right? And obviously because and they are and I not acknowledge this, that they're my children are a privilege state because of who I am, because of the work that I do, because of the knowledge I have around neurodiversity and the movement and everything else. So I can allow for me to advocate for them, to advocate for them to be who they are. But
Yeah.
there are a lot of children out there that don't have that privilege because their parents are learning alongside them.
Yeah, absolutely. So my
Yeah.
daughters have a privilege that our older two didn't have. But yeah, I will now preach radical acceptance because if you're a parent, your job is unconditional love for your child, and you can't do unconditional love without radical acceptance. And you don't have to understand every bit of who a person is to accept them for who they are and support them. Going to keep this going, so we'll have some deeper dives on some specific topics. And like Tony said last time, if there's anything you particularly want us to talk about, we will. And I've got a request for the issue that comes out on the 1st of December that I want to delve into why I have a few issues with Christmas and this whole that whole
Festive
time of
period.
year. Yeah, so there will be some bittersweet memories in that mix and a little bit of trauma, but there will be some humour too, and there will be some good stuff. And I've got no idea what Tony has to say about any of that because we haven't talked about it yet, and we're going to discuss it in front of you guys.
Yep,
So
I want a magic
look
wand to
forward to
get
it.
rid of the elf on the shelf.
Yeah. Mummy has enough on her plate.
Yes, I don't want elf on the shelf. Brilliant. Great. Well, as always, it's been enlightening. I've learnt from Charlie today. And I think I'm looking forward to more discussion and more sharing.
Me
And
too.
we'll see you in
I
a
want to
couple
see
of
some
weeks.
pictures of you with the streak in your hair and
Oh, I'll have to
doing the
find them now.
ballroom dancing and things as well.
Oh
Yeah.
no. Oh, brilliant.
Thank you.
Thanks.